the Mass because of the pandemic. But also, you know, some people have simply lapsed over time. And we want to concentrate people on the Eucharist, which is the center of our Christian life. So today, finally, we get to modern times. And in terms of history, modern times start in 1500. It's the end of the Middle Ages, the beginning of the modern age. And I'm just going to go through, you know, what is written here. Really, you've got everything here. But first of all, to think of what it means to be the modern age, the changes that came about. One of the most important was the inventing of printing. You know, if you think up to this time, producing books had been an incredibly difficult process. There was no paper to start with. You had to use parchment, or, you know, the parchment was made of animal skins, which had to be prepared extremely carefully. You know, you can imagine shaving off all the hair and then, you know, stretching them out and drying them. That produced a good surface. And so books were incredibly expensive. But then you've got the invention of paper and finally printing. And so in 1450, Gutenberg began the first printing press with movable type. And in 1455, he completed a Bible. It was a Latin Bible, obviously. And, you know, that Gutenberg Bible is an amazing breakthrough. Also, at the end of this time, the end of the Middle Ages, Columbus discovered the Americas, you know, came to the what is now the Dominican Republic in 1492. And then, you know, they came up to Florida, first of all, in 1513, although they didn't settle here immediately. In 1510, the Portuguese went in the other direction and made a permanent settlement in Goa in 1510. And in 1513, they reached as far as China. So the world was expanding in an extraordinary way. You know, up to this time, through the Middle Ages, everything is Eurocentric. Everything is based in Europe. But now they begin to discover that the world is much bigger than they ever imagined. Meanwhile, in Europe, there was the beginning of what we call Protestantism, that is, a protesting against the Catholic Church. So Martin Luther began to look at the church in a negative way and began all kinds of public criticism of the church, leading to his excommunication in 1520. He was an Augustinian friar, you know, living in a community. He was an intelligent man, a writer, a teacher, but then he broke away from the church and he left the order. He married in 1525 and the next year began organizing his own church, an independent church. So here in the West, really, almost for the first time, there were Christians who were not part of the Catholic Church. In France, kind of same kind of influence, John Calvin led a breakaway Protestant church from the 1530s. In 1534, the English king, Henry VIII, made himself supreme head of the church. And so we get, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, and then in England, there is the Church of England, with instead of the Pope as the head, there is the King as the head. And at the same time, Henry carried out a destruction of the medieval church. The greatest thing he did, the most terrible thing he did, was destroy all the monasteries. England and Wales were covered in monasteries. And they were the social services of the time. They looked after the poor. They ran education. They had infirmaries for the sick. You know, there was none of that organized by the state. It was all done by the monasteries. But Henry VIII simply saw them and said, oh, well, these monasteries are rich. They have lands. He didn't realize that they were using all their money to help the local people. And so he took the monastery buildings, he took all their lands, they were distributed to friends of his. You know, the various nobles of England became richer and richer, and suddenly the poor people had no help at all. So, you know, never think that the Reformation, the beginning of Protestantism in England was welcomed. The poor people certainly did not welcome it. And then, in response to all these changes, the Council of Trent met between 1545 and 1563, 25 sessions under three popes. Now, it was difficult to hold a council at that time. You know, people had to travel. It was a long way to travel. And there were wars going on in Europe at the same time, so different people would come to different sessions of the council. But the purpose of the council was to criticize Protestant error and define what is essential in the Catholic faith. And it included a decision to reform the Eucharist. You remember, the Eucharist in the Middle Ages, you know, its form had been finalized, but there were many, many local variations. And Rome could simply not control all these local variations. So the council made its decision, and then it was the job of the Pope to promulgate, you know, to put into effect what the council had decided. You know, that comes later. So in the Apostolic Constitution Quo Primum, comes on the 14th of July, 1570, there was an edition of the Roman Missal. So this was the first time that there had been a Roman Missal for the whole church. Before, there'd been a Roman Missal for Rome, and maybe used by other dioceses around Rome, but there had been a separate Missal in England, a separate one in France, a separate one in Spain. Now, here was a Missal for obligatory use throughout the Western Church. Now, there were a few exceptions. For example, if there was a rite where there was at least two centuries of use, then that could carry on. And so the Ambrosian rite carried on. That was the rite of Milan in Italy, going back to St. Ambrose. The Dominican order, they had their own rite. And in fact, those rites continue even now. In the cathedral in Milan, you will have the Ambrosian rite with just slight differences from what we have now. Now, the secret to having a missal for the whole world, as it were, was having authorized printers. The Vatican appointed certain printers that it could trust. So it would send them an example, and then they would set up their printing blocks and they would print the missals. And any addition, subtraction, or change was forbidden. So these printers knew if they wanted to keep this work, they must be absolutely faithful to the text that they were given. Now, in the Vatican itself, the missal had to be put into use within 1 month. Well, that was because the Vatican had its own printing press, and so it was easy to have copies and just to hand them out in the Vatican, in the local Rome area. Those on the Italian side of the Alps were given 3 months. And there were probably printing presses at Florence, maybe Milan, and Venice. You know, those would be the authorized printers. Those on the north of the Alps, France, Britain, Germany, they had 6 months. So it was recognizing that it would take time for the printers to get the official edition and, you know, and then have it printed and distributed. And in that constitution, the Pope said, if someone dares to change anything, let him know that he incurs immediate excommunication. And, you know, that was in a kind of like an official statement. If somebody changed, by that very act, they were excommunicated. Now, what kind of missal was sent out to these printers? It could have been, you know, a completely new missal. Or he could have produced a historical missal, you know, looking back over the centuries and selecting the best prayers. But there was a kind of time constraint. They felt they needed to get on with this. So there wasn't time for historical research. So instead, he chose to use an existing rite. And this was the Missal according to the observance of the Roman Curia of 1474. So for the Vatican, they had already produced a missal in 1474. It was the latest edition of what they were using in the Vatican. And pretty much that is the missal that was used. And the only changes they made is that they decided the calendar would have the major saints, which would be kind of acceptable throughout the world, and then there would be local saints, which could be added on in the local missals, and obviously there would be some local Roman saints as well. But in that missal, many, many feasts were cut, and also little things like the Gloria had been added to. That came down to as it should have been. Now, up to this time, through the Middle Ages, there had only been an elevation of the host. Remember I said that it was the host that became the center of the Mass. Well, here there was an elevation of the cup as well. And of course, that's what we're used to now. There was a ritual for the communion of the faithful. In the Middle Ages, the people had almost ceased to go to communion. Only the priest made his communion. And so now there were some little prayers for the people if they were going to communion. Although it was still very, very rare. It was kind of rare for people at least to go to communion at Mass. what would they, is more likely is that they would go to Mass, and then later on, after Mass, they would go to the tabernacle and the priest would give them communion. But at least there was the possibility of communion of the faithful and preparatory prayers. It's a little bit strange. There's two absolutions in that preparation. No penitential rite at the beginning, not for the people, but that a little sort of penitential rite before communion for the lay people. There also came back a dismissal, which had been there in the ancient rites of the church, but had kind of disappeared. But it's very, very odd. If you look at the Tridentine Missal, the dismissal comes before the final blessing. So, you know, there was a dismissal saying, go in peace. You know, the Mass is ended, go in peace. But then nobody did go. Now, one of the great convenient things about the Tridentine Missal is that the readings were in the Missal. This was a huge help for the priests. You know, they didn't have to take around two or three books. Everything was there in the Missal. But to get it in, it meant you didn't have a great variety of readings. You know, you would have the Sunday reading for each Sunday of Advent, and then you would just repeat those readings all through the week following. You know, we're so used now to a variety of readings. But, you know, most of you, pretty much everybody here, I think, you know, you grew up with the Tridentine Mass. You never realized probably that the readings were just the same every single day. But it was popular, you know. People were delighted to have this missal. It was all in one book. The individual diocese no longer had the expense of working out their own missal. And Catholics had a sense that, you know, that thing with the Tridentine Mass, wherever you go in the world, the Mass is the same. You know, this sense of the unity of Catholicism against the variety of the Protestants. Well, this Tridentine Mass lasted pretty much for 400 years. And the next pope, after the Missal was printed, created a special department of the Curia, that is, of the Vatican administration, the Congregation of Rites and Ceremonies. And the idea was, the words are the same for everybody, let's make sure that the ceremonies, the way people move and everything, are exactly the same. So to see to it that the sacred rites are exactly observed in all places and by all persons in the churches of Rome and of the universe, you know, all through the world. In other words, local dioceses lost all liberty to make changes. Eventually, if anyone had the slightest doubt about how to do something in the Mass, they would consult Rome about it. And then Rome would make a ruling. And every month from Rome, there would be a little printed, kind of like a pamphlet, which gave all the decisions of the Congregation of Rites. You know, somebody had brought up some tiny little thing. So here's just one example, you know, what to do at the offertory. Because there was this thing, the altar server had to kiss the priest's hand when he handed him anything. So here they're laying down exactly the order of things to be done. When the deacon presents something, for example, the paten or the chalice, to the celebrant clothed in his vestments. He first kisses the object, then the hand of the celebrant. And when he receives something from the celebrant, he first kisses the hand and then the object. When he has incense blessed, he receives the incense boat first with his right hand and transferring it to his left hand. With his right hand, he presents to the celebrant the spoon, which he kisses at the end that the celebrant will take, and then kisses the celebrant's hand. So every little inch, you know, every little detail is thought of. And, you know, the idea was that everywhere in the world, people should be doing exactly the same things. Well, I mean, I can imagine it never really happened because people couldn't remember all these details, exactly how they were to do things. And, you know, if you were a missionary in Africa or something like that, you know, saying Mass on a rough wooden table and, you know, distracted by the flies and everything, you would forget little details like this. But there was an obsession, you know, the words were fixed, but there was also an obsession about these rubrics. Now, rubrics are the instructions in the missal about what you are to do. They're called rubrics because they're printed in red. In these ancient missals, it's actually the same now. What you say is in black. What you do is in red. The Latin word for red is ruber. So rubrics are the things printed in red. And there are always, you know, stories about newly ordained priests who don't understand this distinction. And they read through the page, they read the rubrics and the words as well, you know, out aloud. I don't know if there's any happened, but, you know, it's one of those horror tales that they tell to newly ordained priests. Now, the use of Latin was absolute. Wherever you were in the world, you used Latin. The only people who used different languages were the Orthodox churches. You know, they used Greek as they had all through the time. But Rome, you know, didn't have an influence over those churches. Now, up until 1898, it was prohibited to translate the prayers of the Mass into modern languages. So, you know, if a child wanted to know what's going on at Mass, somebody could do a little book describing what was going on, but they could not translate the words. The words were kind of considered something so holy that ordinary people shouldn't understand what they were, or the only people who could understand were the highly educated who knew Latin well. Now, when people went into church, they had prayer books, which they would hold during the Mass. But the books at this time, this is at the end of the 19th century, didn't include the Mass prayers. During Mass, they would also say the Rosary. And so it was as if the Mass, which they could barely hear, remember, the priest was turned away from them. There were no microphones and things. So you wouldn't hear the Mass, you know, because the priest would not be talking in a loud voice. He'd be almost whispering. So the people would hardly hear the Mass. Most of them couldn't understand it, even if they did hear, because it was in Latin. So it was something holy going on in the background of their prayers. Only the altar server made the responses to the Mass. And it was, you know, it was a big thing. I mean, some of you maybe were altar servers. And, you know, it was drilled into you. You had to know those Mass responses in Latin. Now, if they went to communion, if people did go to communion, it was usually after an early Mass and what we would call a low Mass. You know, they would go at 8 o'clock. But the high Mass, there would not be communions. There would be a high Mass later in the day, and this, you know, might have the deacon and the subdeacon and music and everything. But in a way, it was kind of like a concert, because the music was very elaborate. You know, there were many, many beautiful Mass settings written at this time. All through this time of the Tridentine Mass, all the great composers wrote Mass settings. But they were often very, very long. And because they were long, people kind of lost where they were in the Mass. They didn't have a sense of the structure of the Mass. And when the Gloria started, or the Creed started, the music for it, everybody would sit down because it was going to take a long time. You know, there was no question of people joining in the Creed. It was only for the choir to say. And so even the priest, the deacon and subdeacon, there would be seats at the side of the church, and they would go and sit there. You know, it was too much, considered too much for them to have to stand through, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes of the Gloria or the Creed. And at this time, in the 19th century, you know, or again, right up to the Second Vatican Council, the priests had hats, what we call berettas, you know, these black hats which the priests and deacons had. I don't know if you remember those. But when they went and sat down during the Gloria, the master of ceremonies, the chief server, would hand them their hats, and they would put their hats on. The only thing was, if there was a mention in the Gloria or the Creed of the name of Jesus, they had to take their hats off. And so they would lift their hats at the name of Jesus. So they had to kind of keep alert because, you know, with the different music, you would be kind of listening out. You wouldn't always sort of know where the name came. So you would carefully. And, you know, if you had a good master of ceremonies, he would kind of, you know, be there to indicate when the time was to lift your hat. Now, during all this time of the Tridentine Mass, scholars were discovering the ancient liturgies of the church. You know, in monasteries, old manuscripts had been kept. In Eastern monasteries, some of these were extremely ancient manuscripts which were discovered. And they were transcribed, translated, and people were kind of amazed to discover the history of the liturgy. And people began to realize the Mass had had many different forms over the years. And this discovery and also then the desire to reflect that in modern times is what we call the liturgical movement. It was particularly strong in Germany and France. And so already certain changes were made. Pius X had a great love of the liturgy. And in 1903, he encouraged the ordinary people to sing Gregorian chant. It's a simple chant. So instead of having choirs doing elaborate music, the Pope said, it's better to have the simple music of the chant, which the people can join in. You know, this is the first time they were joining in anything. In 1905, he invited people to make their communion more frequently, even daily. And in 1910, he extended this to children who had reached the age of reason. You know, it's from this time that we get kind of first communion from the age of 7. Up until this time, people had often waited a long time to make their first communion. And, you know, we think back of Pius X now. Was he a dangerous liberal? I don't think so, no. But he began to introduce these changes. Then from the 1920s, you began to get beautifully printed missals which were available with Latin on one side of the page and your own language on the other side. As I said, you know, up until this time, that had not been allowed. But from the 1920s, it was. I mean, I have mine here. This is a St. Joseph Missal from the end of the 1950s. Latin on one side, the English translation on the other, with the readings and everything. So people finally could follow the Mass. Everybody could follow the Mass. And I bet all of you in your homes at some point had one of these. And they are absolutely wonderfully printed. Again, you know, certain printers were entrusted with this. There were great printers in Belgium at this time who were producing these missals. And then in 1951, Pius XII restored the Easter Vigil. The Easter Vigil had pretty much disappeared. In 1955, you got the rest of Holy Week restored. You know, Holy Week, the special ceremonies of Holy Week had pretty much disappeared, or they were kind of disguised because, you know, for example, Good Friday, you would have the ceremonies early in the morning, and really almost nobody would come to them. And in 1958, there was what was called a dialogue mass. And this was a big breakthrough. In other words, when the priest said, "The Lord be with you," instead of just the server replying in Latin, the people were allowed to talk, to make a response. And this was, you know, considered an extraordinary thing that ordinary people were allowed to speak during the Mass and make the responses. So even, you know, under what we consider the old times, there was change. Change was already coming about. And then the real change did come, you know, the real kind of the modern age. And so the last page of the Mass of the Second Vatican Council. On October 28, 1958, Angelo Roncalli was elected the 261st Pope, and he chose the name John XXIII. He was 76. I mean, poor man, you know, becoming Pope at 76. What a responsibility. And, you know, they thought they really couldn't decide who they wanted as Pope, so he was acceptable and just a stopgap to give them some time. And in fact, he only reigned for 4.5 years. But what he did do, and this was an extraordinary thing, he called a new ecumenical council. It was the 21st council in the history of the church, and is now what we call Vatican II. During the 19th century, there'd been a Vatican I. Now, this was Vatican II. And The bishops met from October 1962, 9 months before John's death, until December 1965. So a lot of it was under Paul VI. The first complete document to be issued was called Sacrosanctum Concilium. You know, these titles of the documents from Rome, they always start with the first Latin words. And it was the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy. And that document, it had to be voted on by the bishops. So there was the basic document, there was a discussion about it, then there were little changes made in committee. Then there was the final document presented to the bishops, and their vote was 2,147 in favor, 4 against. So, you know, sometimes people say nobody wanted the changes to the liturgy. You know, everybody still wanted the Tridentine Mass to carry on. But here, the bishops of the church, representing all parts of the world, and, you know, 2,147 to 4, you know, they were in favor of these changes. They felt it was necessary. And, you know, these weren't, again, these men, these were people who'd grown up in the Tridentine Mass. You know, these were not liberals in any sense at all. They were faithful Catholic bishops. But they saw there was a need for change. So finally, the bishops voted, Pope Paul VI promulgated the document. It became official December the 4th, 1963. Now, the main aim was to achieve greater lay participation in the Catholic Church's liturgy. So, like the Dialogue Mass, you know, it was to make like the Dialogue Mass permanent, you know, that there would be responses. And also that radical thing of having the Mass in the languages of the people. But at the same time, there was a very thorough revision, aided by the advice of great scholars, because, you know, people knew much more about how the Mass had been through the centuries at this time. And it took 7 years, almost 7 years, to put together the new Missal. You know, whereas the Tridentine Missal had been done rather quickly, this, they took a long time over it. So finally, there was the new Latin Missal in 1970. And then there was an English translation ready by 1973. Because every document of the Catholic Church, the official edition is the Latin edition, particularly of all the sacraments and the Missal and so on. The official edition is the Latin edition, and then you have to translate it, and you have to get the approval of Rome of the translation, that it is an accurate translation. So all of this took some time. And when the text was ready, Pope Paul presented it to the church and commented on the major changes. So, to the single canon, that is the Eucharistic prayer of the previous edition, and that prayer was preserved as Eucharistic prayer number 1, or is called the Roman canon, there was then the addition of 3 alternative Eucharistic prayer. And there was a huge increase in the number of prefaces for the various Eucharistic prayers to reflect the seasons. But the Missal now, you know, we're used to that. Usually, the Mass you will hear almost every day is Eucharistic prayer number two. It's the shortest one. On Sundays, you're more likely to hear Eucharistic prayer number three. It's a slightly longer one. On some kind of special occasions, we'll use Eucharistic prayer number one, the Roman canon, the Tridentine Mass, because that has got special little additions, for example, for Easter and for Christmas. And then there's Eucharistic prayer number four, which really was a completely new invention. It was quite popular at the beginning. It's not used so much now. And then since then, the church has added some additional Eucharistic prayers for reconciliation and for particular needs. They're not used a lot. You won't hear them, but Father Bauman sometimes uses them, the Eucharistic prayer of reconciliation. And usually he'll tell you, he'll say, today I'm going to use this particular prayer. The rites of the order of the Mass, that is the largely unvarying parts of it, were simplified while due care is taken to preserve their substance. And he said, elements which with the passage of time came to be duplicated or were added with but little advantage were eliminated. So this funny little preparation for communion that there had been with two absolutions in the Tridentine Rite, the preparation for communion, there was instead like a penitential rite at the beginning of the Mass for everybody, for priest and people together. You may remember that at the end of Mass, there was something called the Last Gospel, which was a reading of the beginning of St. John's Gospel. So, you know, after the dismissal in the old Mass, after the blessing, the priest would say this Last Gospel. He'd say it at the altar, or he would say it quietly to himself as he processed out of the church. But you know, people didn't hear it. And then because the new Mass wanted to focus on the real gospel, the gospel of the day, that was simply eliminated. And there were all these just simplifications of ceremonies and words at the offertory, the breaking of the bread and the communion, where over the years there'd been an accumulation of prayers. Then he said, other elements which have suffered injury through accidents of history are now to be restored to the earlier norm of the Holy Fathers. For example, the homily, the prayer of the faithful, and the penitential rite of the people. You know, the homily had pretty much disappeared. Sometimes you get homilies at the end of Mass. But here, the homily came back, and it was meant to be a commentary on the gospel. The prayer of the faithful had disappeared. But we know it was there in the second century of the church and had been there, you know, for many, many years. So that came back, and the penitential rite at the beginning. Now, what made a huge change was the attitude of the church to the Bible, the importance of the Bible, the reading of the Bible at Mass. In the Tridentine Mass, only 1% of the Old Testament was read, 16.5% of the New Testament. In Pope Paul's revision, 13.5% of the Old Testament was read, you know, all the kind of the major narrative of the Old Testament, you would get all of that. And 71.5% of the New Testament is read at Mass. So in the course of 3 years, you know, Catholics get a very, very good exposition of the Bible. Now, he was able to do this by having 3 readings on Sundays with a 3-year cycle and a 2-year cycle on weekdays. And priests were encouraged to preach on the scriptures. You know, the church says again and again, the gospel, the Sunday gospel, should be the heart of the preaching on Sunday. So, finally, there were the translations. Now, I remember when I was pastor of St. Charles, I found there the old missal. Now, it was the old Latin missal, the last edition of the Tridentine missal, but the priests had stuck in the typed pages. So the Eucharistic prayer there was already in English. So I suspect that happened in quite a few American churches. The priests just went ahead. The official translation was not ready, but they began to have translations of the Mass and to use it. But kind of officially, the new translation didn't come out until 1973. So most of you would have been exposed to the Latin Mass for a long time. You know, you really would have known it well. In 1975, there was a new Latin edition. And that was because, you know, that maybe there were various typos or new feasts of saints that needed to be brought in. So they brought out a new Latin edition, and then a third edition in 2000. As I said, you know, the official edition of the Missal is always the Latin one. And so some churches would continue with their older English edition, some would get a new English edition. But after 2000, there was concern about how good the translations were. And there was a kind of two attitudes about translation. One was getting the meaning over, even if it wasn't literally what the word said. The other was that it was a literal translation, even if it was difficult to understand, because it was a literal translation of the Latin. So there was this effort to begin a completely new English translation of the Missal. So you had one translation of the Missal for 40 years. And the funny thing is, I don't think anybody really complained about that. I don't know, can you remember saying, oh, this is a terrible translation of the Latin, you know, and complaining? I don't think anybody did. But it was just this new attitude that really the translation should be literal. And some of the translation has been good, some of it has been rather awkward. You know, we have the Lord be with you and with your spirit. That's exactly what the Latin says. And in a way, that's a good translation because it says the people want the Lord to be with the priest, to be with the spirit of the priest, to help him to say the Mass well. Whereas before, the Lord be with you and also with you. You know, it's sort of, it's not spiritual, which is as it was meant to be. It's not to do with a devout saying of the Mass. But some of the new translations have been awkward. Some of them were plain wrong. You know, a couple of years ago, this letter came from Rome and said, by the way, the translation of all the collects, that is, the opening prayers of the Mass, is wrong because the conclusion is wrong. Because the conclusion said, through our Lord Jesus Christ, your Son, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever. That's what the translation was, even in the new translation of the Missal. But if you look at the Latin, it doesn't say one God, because it's not talking about the Trinity being one God. It's about Jesus. It simply says Deus, God. So now we say, through our Lord Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, God forever and ever. It's talking about Jesus, that he is God. So, you know, that was a pretty big mistake to make. And funnily enough, in England, there was an alternative translation. They got that right at the beginning. But this mistaken translation continued. So now the priests have to remember not to say one God, although it's written there. Actually at Nativity, there was a very, very good sacristan. He went through the Missal with that white out, that little painting brush, took out all the ones, so to help Father David there to get it right. So it's a complicated thing, the thing of translation. And remember, you know, the new Mass, we have it in English, you have it in all the different languages, you have it in Latin as well. When I was a Benedictine in England, we had the English Mass one day, the Latin Mass the next day. But it was always the new Missal. And I don't think, you know, people coming in, they would have thought, oh, they're having the Tridentine Missal. No, it was the new Missal. And that's still the official Missal of the Church. Well, who knows, you know? We're getting on in life, most of us here. But will there be changes? There are going to be some changes, because with the new translation of the Missal, there has to be translation of the baptismal rite. That's been done. There's been new translation of the marriage rite. We're waiting for a new translation of the funeral rite. So all these things, it takes a long time. And you know, everything has to be approved by Rome. But in 2017, Pope Francis said, the local bishops' conferences can make decisions about liturgical matters. Not everything, but if there are little things, then those can be decided. So I think, you know, some of the things, the changes that were made during the pandemic, they were made by the local bishops' conferences. They didn't have to take every little matter to Rome. And thank goodness for that. It made it much simpler. So in that way, we're kind of returning to the Middle Ages, where the local churches had more authority. Well, maybe there will be changes in the future. Who knows? But I hope you've seen through this history that the Mass has not really changed that much from, you know, what we read. The basics are there in the New Testament. The form of the Mass was very much established by the second century. There is this amazing continuity. And that continuity is, of course, in us, we who come to Mass regularly. We are the continuity, and we must remain faithful. Well, thank you for being here. God bless you all for listening.